Oh, those intrepid, spunky, heroic Alaskans. They wrote their own constitution, they elected their own representatives, then they went to Washington and they kept up the pressure until Congress gave us statehood, right? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Now that we're about done patting ourselves on the back for 50 years of statehood, maybe it's time for a closer look. Our phone number 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. Statehood, yet again the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. This message sponsored by ANSEP. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, the book is finally out. Terrence Cole is professor of history at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he wrote a book entitled Fighting for the 49th Star, C.W. Snedden, and the Crusade for Alaska Statehood. And he joins us now by telephone from his home in Fairbanks. Terrence, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Well, Terrence, what happened? Did you miss your deadline here? I mean, you would think that you'd sell books a lot better if you got out before the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, it was a little slow. The whole idea was that this book was supposed to be done, of course, in advance of 2009, but it took me an extra couple of years, but the reason why, and this is what I had to justify to everyone, including my kids and my wife, about why I was still working on this dang thing, was that it was just a lot more interesting and also difficult than I thought. And frankly, I'm embarrassed to say that by the time I got done with it, how little I had known when I started about the story. And I think that for Alaskans today, I'm sure there's a sort of a little bit of a statehood weariness, and everybody thinks they know all about it, and that there isn't any more to tell. And it's a little bit like the bicentennial. I know many of our listeners aren't old enough to remember the bicentennial, but I think you are, Steve.
I am, indeed.
Oh, I thought you were, yeah. But anyway, and me too. We both are. But anyway, when they had the bicentennial minutes on public television, and we'd see more like, bicentennial half hours. But anyway, so we're a little bit like that. And of course, on one side, that's good. It was an education campaign, and I was part of that. We were working on a historical appreciation of statehood, because in fact, when in large part it was spearheaded by the university, going back to the writing of the 50th anniversary of the writing of the Constitution, because we sort of decided, that there really wasn't much of an appreciation by the people of Alaska about what statehood had meant. And I know, now we've had a lot of press and publicity about it over the last 5 or 6 years, but anyway, so my book about fighting for the 49th star was is a sort of a whole entirely new look at the question, and it is late, 2 years too late, but I figured in the long scheme of things that was more important. I got the story right. So,
well, I think one of the reasons, and you got into this a little bit there, but one of the reasons that it might have taken you so long is because it is never easy when there is an established paradigm. And, I've done this sometimes where I'm working a story and I suddenly realize, oh, this is really a big story. This story says that things aren't the way we thought they were. And, every journalist loves that sort of story. But at the same time, you have all this new responsibility, because then you got to triply go back and check your facts and say, oh, am I absolutely sure that it really was this way and not the way everybody always thought it was? And the minute you start busting a couple of paradigms like that, you're talking a lot of extra work, not to mention a lot of extra concern. And I think you have a few points in this book that give us a different look.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, the main thing, I think that's right. It's how when you start something and it turns out not to be the way you thought it was, you know, it's like trying to get from point A to point B, and you realize there's, you know, point C is between point A and point B, so you're not going to get there the way that you thought so easily. But in particular, in the case of statehood, somebody asked me once, well, why? And this was in the middle of the statehood celebration stuff that we had done for the Constitution. And I said, well, why did it take so long? And I thought about it, and I didn't really have a very good answer. So that was the real sort of question I sort of set out to answer. And predominantly the story told in Alaska was that the opposition of fishing and mining interests, in particular, going back to the 1950s, put the kibosh on statehood again and again. Now, this was true in the early, as probably as late as 1950, but really not after 1950. Up to 1950, you could probably say that had a major influence. But after 1950, that really melted away, and the predominant issue that kept Alaska out of the Union was a very simple one, civil rights for African Americans in the South. That was the first issue, that was the second issue, that was the third issue. The case of Alaska entering the Union was all about civil rights. And the reason being is that the Southern Democrats who are in control of the Senate, the key committees on the Senate, they were the chairman in the years when the Republicans were in control, the one brief 2-year stretch, 53 to 55, whether they were the ranking members on the key Senate standing committees, were all Southern Democrats. And it was their opposition that was the core of the Alaska problem. And then I came to realize this in the course of writing this. You know, we always talked about, well, Alaska was always justifying itself in congressional hearings and newspaper editorials, et cetera. Well, we have enough of an economy to join the Union. We have these reasons, and basically those points were, you know, they were important, but they were relatively minor, because the issue was not whether or not Alaska was ready to join the Union. The issue was whether or not the Union was ready to accept Alaska. It's a completely separate way, and so I kind of took the attitude of this as a statehood fight from Washington, D.C., and that's where the decision is made. It's a decision of the Congress and the president. It really has nothing to do with a popular vote or anything like that. It's strictly a congressional prerogative initially, and then to be signed or not by the president.
Yeah, so well, they did. When they finally passed the thing, they did require this plebiscite, you know, for Alaskans to approve of it, as I recall.
Right, and the interesting thing about the plebiscite was that in the context, there were a few vocal opponents of statehood in Alaska. Not so many. I mean, matter of fact, in retrospect, a couple of different times, people have raised the question, well, what about those who spoke against statehood in the territory? Well, there were a few.
Cap Lathrop was not all that for it.
Oh, no. Well, I should say that's right. I mean, of course, and he died in 1950, but good point, Steve. I guess I'm oversimplifying.
Yeah, Jay Hammond always said he didn't really think it was all that good an idea either.
Well, Hammond's probably the most notable sort of politician who later became, and partly that was just his orneriness, you know, that he just that was just his way. But the territorial legislature for about 5 or 6 sessions in a row, I forget how many, passed resolutions unanimously endorsing statehood throughout the 50s, unanimously. Everybody voted for it. And so it there wasn't really, and in fact, there was a group called the Alaska Referendum Committee. It was run by a woman named Alice Stewart out of Fairbanks. And so her whole point was to insist that there had to be another election about statehood. And she kept saying, well, we never had a simple election about for statehood or against statehood. Now, she was a typical sort of Fairbanks crank, Alice Statehood. You know, she would show up at these meetings with a stack full of papers and books and start her testimony. And on several occasions, they'd have to interrupt her and say, you know, excuse me, ma'am, what are you talking about? But anyway, the end point of all of her story always was, and remember, she was the chairman of the Alaska Referendum Committee, we wanted another referendum. Well, that was even though people had voted for the Constitution overwhelmingly. They voted overwhelmingly against fish traps. They voted for the Alaska-Tennessee Plan delegation to go back and lobby for statehood overwhelmingly. And the legislature, as I said, voted these unanimous resolutions all the time. Well, anyway, it turned out the Alaska Referendum Committee was her. There was no other members of it. It was just her. She admitted this on a couple of occasions, even though she had letterhead printed out. There were no other members of it. It was just her. So anyway, I think that the interesting thing about for us is that we did have this plebiscite in 1958, but it was put in specifically in the statehood bill by Ted Stevens. Actually, it was his suggestion. And it was to squelch the people who were demanding other votes before statehood. They figured this would be a way of having a vote. It would pass overwhelmingly, and it wouldn't cost any money because it would be it was sort of built into the Statehood Act. And in fact, that's what happened. So actually, the part of the fact we had a referendum was to take care of the few people in Alaska who actually opposed statehood, and it passed by a 5-1 margin. So in a way, it became a big thing for former Governor Wally Hickel, who passed away last year. That the Alaska Statehood Act was a compact with the people, in part because of this vote, and the reason the vote happened was entirely optional. You see, because Congress could have made us a state, and the president in most states become states without elections. It's strictly up to the federal government to decide this. The people of a territory don't get to vote in most cases.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to this business of the Tennessee Plan. We did have this kind of tale that almost got tiresome about how, you know, the intrepid, hardy Alaskans wrote their own constitution and elected their own delegates, even though they weren't actually members of the union yet, and they went to Washington and acted as if they were, until Washington gave in and saw the light and gave us our rights. And you know, it turns out that maybe, you know, certainly the correspondence from Bob Bartlett and so forth indicates that they weren't all that effective, that the Tennessee Plan delegation went to Washington, but that doesn't mean that they accomplished that much.
All right. Well, I mean, one of the big things, and that's a good point, Steve. You know, one of the issues is that in sort of our statehood story, obviously writing the Constitution plays an enormous role because it was a it was an act of protest against the federal government, writing the Alaska Constitution. And because everything had failed and we had been blocked repeatedly up to 1955, and finally it was decided, well, we got to do something to get off the mark, so let's write a constitution. Now, many Alaskans were convinced writing the Constitution was a dumb idea, a foolish waste of money. And there wasn't much support for this initially from Anchorage because Bob Atwood, who had been a champion of statehood for years in the Anchorage Times, thought it was just another diversion because the people opposed to statehood, the few people in Alaska opposed to statehood, always kept raising. They had three objections, you know. They said not now. We're not ready now. We're not ready with this bill. So not now and not this bill, even though in reality what they meant was not never, you know. I mean, well, or never. But they meant statehood never. The opposition to this was overcome, and they decided to, on the recommendation of Tom Stewart of Juneau, to write a constitutional convention in Fairbanks where it would be separated from the, as one of them said, the flesh pots of Juneau. I'm not sure. There's a lot of flesh pots in Juneau, but anyway.
Well, as a matter of fact, at the time, I think there were still some flesh pots hanging out there.
Well, that's true. They were
in Fairbanks.
Fairbanks
too.
That's right. And there
I
were.
Mean, that's part of how Ted Stevens made his reputation, wasn't it?
Busting. It is. That's right. Yeah.
Busting the houses of ill repute there as a prosecutor.
Yeah, that is correct. So we did have ours. I guess maybe they weren't as well known as those of Juneau, but when the Constitution was written. It's an act of protest, and the ultimate protest that was appended to it was this, okay, we're going to elect our own shadow delegates, not delegates, congressional delegation. So we're going to act like we're already a state, and that's what the Tennessee plan was. It had been the suggestion of a Louisiana man named George Lee Leitner, who came up here, and he suggested that he was actually a fascinating character. He had originally proposed this for Hawaii for years and never got any ground headway. And then he finally came to Alaska in 1955 when he heard they were going to write a constitution. And he suggested, listen, I've got this idea. And the idea was that back in 1796, Tennessee had elected a congressional delegation before they were a state. And about half a dozen other states followed Tennessee's lead. Well, this had not been done since the 19th century, and in a way, it really was sort of just a promotional stunt. But in the 19th century, it was somewhat effective because of the fact of the lack of communications and no mass newspapers and everything at the time. It seemed to be more sort of sensible. And so anyway, we have, in fact, adopted this idea of the Tennessee plan and elected a slate of three Democratic, a three-man Democratic delegation, Ernest Greening and Bill Egan on the Senate side, and Ralph Rivers in the House. Now, the problem was that, what impact did this have? Well, they were, Bob Bartlett was convinced this was a bad idea. He was Alaska's man in Washington, D.C., as the delegate since 1944, and
he deliberately decided not to be a part of the Tennessee plan, right?
Correct. And Bill Snedden, C.W. Snedden, who was kind of the focus of my book, Snedden was the big pusher, promoter of this in Alaska, and he thought the key to making it work was having Bob Bartlett be one of these Tennessee plan delegates. And a representative or senator. He actually wanted Bartlett to be one of the senators, and partly this also had to do with the way that Ernest Greening was such a lightning rod. Ernest Greening had been the territorial governor for 13 years and was a brilliant man and a person who a gifted writer and speaker, but who really was quite ineffective when it came to lobbying because he was the one, he liked to hear himself talk and wasn't that interested in what the other guy had to say usually. So it was very difficult to win votes that way in Congress. So Greening, as a member of this team, you know, Bartlett was convinced that was the reason it didn't work, is that Greening was one of these senators. Bill Snedden thought, as a solid Republican, he thought the reason the Tennessee plan wasn't effective was that they were all Democrats. Because they went back to a Congress that was controlled by the Democrats at that time in 1955, just been taken back over by the Democrats. But the White House was Republican, Eisenhower, and he refused to see them, actually. He even refused to see the delegation. So they were shunted aside to the sort of legislative Siberia from the beginning. And so Bartlett was believed in many years, and he would never say this publicly. He actually is very often in his correspondence, which is what I base the book on, actually, is Bob Bartlett's, the principal source is Bob Bartlett's correspondence, because he was a fantastic writer. He was funny. He was incisive. He was empathetic. He was just a wonderful, gifted correspondent. And he repeated.
And yet, publicly, everybody liked him.
Right. Oh, yeah.
He didn't have any real power. I mean, he was representing a territory, and yet everybody liked him.
Yeah. I mean, there's no
amazing
question that Bartlett's ability to, because he was a brilliant man, even though, you know, as I put in there, I think, you know, he was the kind of guy you put on a brand new suit, and in about 10 minutes, it looked like he had just come in working on his tractor. You know, he was not what you call a clothes horse. Let's put it that way. And you know, and he was a terrible public speaker, but the affection that he garnered among the fellow members of the House and Senate and among Alaskans was sort of incredible, because he really did have the political gene of being incredibly effective, but also a person that people felt that they could trust. So, but the interesting part about my book about trying to, I think it's interesting after I spent 6 years on it. So maybe I guess I got to leave that to the readers to decide if they think it's interesting. But that this is an untold story of statehood in a way, largely from Bartlett's correspondence. But trying to understand the role that the Republican Party played, particularly in statehood, because Snedden, who was the publisher of the Newsminer, and was he was a Republican before he was born. Let's say that's how loyal he was to the GOP, and he was convinced that the secret for statehood success lay in getting the Republicans to vote for it, because the Southern Democrats, who, as I said, with their dead set opposition on civil rights, they were never going to vote for it. So his Snedden's efforts focused on the White House, President Eisenhower, who had been opposed to statehood for notably or very lukewarm on it, and the Republicans in Congress. And so it's ironic, but in the end, even though traditionally in Alaska, statehood was the initiative of the Democratic Party. In the end, when the vote came to the Senate, more Republicans than Democrats actually voted for Alaska statehood in the Senate. It was 33-31. So the Republican Party was vital in carrying the day. So his role was like huge too. But like I said,
absolutely fascinating. We're talking with Terrence Cole. He's the author of Fighting for the 49th Star, C.W. Snedden and the Crusade for Alaska Statehood, and he teaches history at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And Terrence got hold of the letters of Bob Bartlett and wouldn't let go for 6 years, and finally got his book out. and now we basically have a whole other light on this game of power politics, really. And, you know, you have to say, Snedden cooked up this notion that he could, first off, he had a friend in the White House. He turned out that he got along great with the Interior Secretary, Fred Seaton. And, you know, the newspaper background, whatever it was, these guys just ended up getting along. And Seaton was very influential, being Interior Secretary, on Eisenhower, who was not friendly to statehood at all, and in turning Eisenhower kind of partly as a partisan matter, because Snedden and Stevens sort of cooked up this idea that Alaska was Democratic, but you could turn it Republican if the Republicans would support statehood. And they might not, I don't know, Terrence, if they believed this or not, but that turned out to be exactly what happened.
Yes. That's right, Steve. The funny thing is that, of course, in the 1950s, up to the 1950s, the two territories under consideration, I mean, Hawaii and Alaska, Alaska was seen as the solid Democratic, and Hawaii was solid Republican. And the belief was that if they became states, Alaska would be Democratic forever and Hawaii would be Republican. And exactly the opposite happened. Alaska became Republican and Hawaii became Democratic. And, it's hard, you know, cause and effect is always a difficult thing to prove, but there's no question that it did change the calculus that somehow they drummed up all this support for statehood, or they got statehood to be passed by a Republican administration, and it certainly did help in you know, Alaska becoming a GOP state. Now, it didn't happen overnight, but as you know, it's clear Alaska voted for Nixon in 1960, our first chance to elect a president, and we've never gone Democratic except for LBJ's landslide in 1964. So Alaska has been, for on the presidential side, solidly Republican since 1960, which is sort of stunning that it happened that way. And now one of the things that was a problem for me in this book is that I had all these other issues I thought that had to be covered, and you mentioned one, which was the rise of Ted Stevens. So I have a chapter in there called "The Rise of Ted Stevens." Really, his political start in Alaska came thanks to Mr. Sneddon, the publisher of the Newsminer. And Sneddon came to town in 1950. Stevens got here 3 years later in 1953, and it's fair to say that they became, you know, they were sort of the dynamic duo of crime fighting. And here I guess Ted was Robin, and maybe CW might have been Batman, even though I don't think they were ever dressed up. But one person who was dressed up, I guess, was Ted. His phenomenal career here as district attorney for 3 years is really something. You know, he was a kid. He was the youngest DA in the history of Fairbanks, and immediately when he got the job, largely he got the job because nobody else wanted it, but it was it's stunning following his career of how he and Mr. Sneddon really took on like prostitution, drug trafficking, several serious robberies and murders, because in territorial days it was, you know, the law enforcement was really difficult. So
we're not even going to touch on that murder, but that is so fascinating, the high society murder and everything. I mean, that alone could sell your book.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that it's so difficult for Alaskans now to appreciate what territorial days were like, because we've become so used to being so rich. You know, among the ironies in Alaska becoming a state, virtually everything that people thought would happen didn't happen. You know, instead of Democratic, Alaska became Republican. Instead of being the poorest state in the Union, which is what we thought, we become the richest state in the history of the United States. There's been no state in American history who's ever had the bank account that we do. It's just absolutely incredible. You know, we've had no individual taxation for three decades now. It's amazing. And so to put back into the mindset of territorialism, that's what I tried to do of the issues and the times. And Ted's life, his early life, is a great sort of vehicle for that.
Well, you know, one thing that comes out that really etches this issue of how a territory is in no way a state. I mean, there's the matter of you don't get to vote for president. There's the matter of the colonial power that was held by the canneries, the Seattle cannery interests, you know, that are well known, the mining power and how they could exercise power in Washington and then have, you know, Alaska would just get whiplashed around essentially and didn't have any control. But Ted Stevens got caught up and Sneddon backed him on this issue of mental health, and this is just crazy. You know, not to put too fine a point on it, but Alaskans, if they got in trouble with the mental health system, the federal territorial mental health system, they just got hauled off to the lower 48 and stuck in some institution.
Yeah, I mean, it really is amazing. It is, you know, Alaskans often, you know, complained, and sometimes it was just whining, you know, about the neglect of the federal government. And in some ways, you know, the neglect actually was a good thing, you know, for us. But in the one case, the care of the mentally ill, which the is really probably the darkest chapter in the history of Alaska, because the way that it operated in Alaska through the 1950s was absolutely nothing short of barbaric. What happened was that if someone filed out a written complaint that somebody was insane, The law required that this alleged insane person had to be arrested by the marshal and put in jail, and then they had what they called an insanity jury of I think it's like six people, I guess it was. And so they just picked six people off the street, and then this is how the mechanism worked. If I said, you know, you, Steve Heimel, were insane, I'm not sure if that's ever been alleged or not, but if I did say that, you know, and then they get a six-member jury off the street to decide whether or not you were insane, and, you know, maybe they just didn't like your haircut, but they could vote you being insane and essentially then send you off to the Morningside Sanitarium in Portland, Oregon, which was why the old saying in Alaska was, you know, inside, outside, Morningside, that where you ended up. You know, if you stayed inside long enough in Alaska, you'd be bound eventually outside and then end up in Morningside.
Oi, oi, oi. This is just getting too real for me, Terrence. I'm going to have to take a break. We're talking with Terrence Cole on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of 40 Alaska organizations that provide health care services for those who might otherwise go without. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and Providence Health Services Alaska.
Fighting for the 49th Star, C.W. Snedden and the Crusade for Alaska Statehood, the subject on Talk of Alaska today. We're talking with Terrence Cole, Professor of History, University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Terrence, the last time you were with us on this program, Lily Stevens was in the room here with me, and you probably remember that.
Sure.
And you know what came out about the heritage of Ted Stevens, and Ted plays an important role in your book, was the close association. Essentially, most of this family is lawyers. Lily's a lawyer, Ted was a lawyer, and some of that is a wholehearted commitment to justice. I don't think there's the slightest doubt of that. I mean, in all my encounters with Stevens, I sometimes didn't realize how much of a lawyer he always was. He never really stopped being a lawyer. And I think we really saw this commitment to justice on this issue of inside, outside, Morningside. Here we are in territorial days, and Ted Stevens is fighting for Alaska to become a state so that people won't be subject to mental health hospitalization at basically a whim.
Yeah, well, and one of the interesting things, it's sort of a big part of one chapter in the book, but because of when Ted made his first ever congressional testimony at a congressional a committee to visit Alaska in 1955. So it was really interesting reading his first. This is the first time he actually ever appeared officially before a body of Congress, and he testified against this insanity issue. He had explained he had an insanity hearing. At that time, he had been like DA for a little more than 2 years. He had an insanity hearing about once every 2 weeks. So every 2 weeks, you would bring in somebody off the street and subjected to this barbaric situation where the people are hauled in and you're asking laymen to decide whether or not they're insane. The youngest case ever sent to Morningside was a 17-day-old infant that one of the Alaska juries had judged insane, 17 days old. There was also, and clearly this was just because the parents, whoever it was, couldn't handle the child. There are other cases of little babies, which was the worst thing. There was a 20-month-old toddler whose baby had been charged insane. And I think there were, by 1955, something like 17 children under 8 years of age at Morningside. So, and the thing is, there really was no way to protest against this. So Stevens said, before this testimony at this hearing in Fairbanks, he said, you know, this is like putting your foot in the stomach of a prosecutor. He said this is the worst part of his job. But the big irony of this at the end was, you know, he helped, they promoted this reform legislation that became essentially the Mental Health Act for Alaska, and in which the federal government was going to give 1 million acres to provide for the support of a sort of mental health, to pay for mental health care in Alaska. And it's the descendant of that today is the Mental Health Trust. But the irony about it shows how Alaska was still thought of as this kind of this part that didn't fit in. In the right-wing press, this became the million-acre provision. It got picked up among the extreme right-wing press that this was going to be a million-acre gulag in Alaska. They were going to put all these crazy people who were, you know, right-wingers, essentially. And that was right on the eve of the statehood fight. So I put a little bit good of a section in there talking about how it became the Alaska becoming America's Siberia. And even the National Review, Bill Buckley's magazine, wrote an article debunking this whole thing, but it was just a case of extreme sort of paranoia. But well, anyway, but you're right.
Wait a minute, Terrence. You're telling me that didn't really happen?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're probably right.
I think we do have a lot of right-wingers up here, come to think about it.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. But the million-acre gulag, which they really thought the idea became, okay, this is going to be a fence around this million. It got really sort of thwarted. And I think one of the things that Stevens, and I talked to him quite a few times for the book, it really is an issue of sometimes the not really understanding the situation that Alaska faces. And I think to really appreciate Ted's passion when he was in the Senate on this, you know, and he would get so mad, of course, you know, at a lot of things, sometimes justifiably and sometimes not, but his it went back really to territorial days, that sort of feeling that this was Alaska was a place that was, at the bottom line, misunderstood.
Yeah. Terrence Cole is our guest. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. And email is talk@APRN.org. And we're certainly open for your participation in this program. I'm sure there are people listening right now that are absolutely fascinated, but also people who have a different light they may want to shed or a question or something. It's a fascinating and untold story that Terrence has put forward in fighting for the 49th Star, C.W. Snedden, and the crusade for Alaska statehood. You would think there was nothing more to be said after all the fall to roll of the 50th anniversary, but now we can get down to the real story, maybe. And what we get is the Tennessee Plan delegation basically ends up with, you know, Bill Egan is Bill Egan, as always, glad-hander, and as he always was, and Ernest Greening always off pontificating, and Ralph Rivers kind of missing in action, and that is our Tennessee Plan delegation. And meanwhile, there's Bob Bartlett, the actual delegate of the territory, and then there's Ted Stevens, who's gone to work for the Interior Secretary now and put an Alaska sign on his office as the solicitor for the Interior Department. And there's this publisher of a newspaper in Fairbanks who is actually more time than not staying in a hotel in Washington, D.C. when it gets really tense.
Well, especially in 57, 58. That's right. You know, I think that, like I said, the difficult part of the story has been that because statehood was a Democratic initiative here. I mean, really, the Democratic Party took the lead, and the Republican Party, essentially in the 1950s, the early 1950s, didn't exist in Alaska. You know, one guy said, and I don't think he was too far off the mark, he said the Republican Party in Alaska was simply one cranky old man in each town. And I think there might have been something to that in the early days.
Oh, them was the days.
Yeah. So, but anyway, they Snedden saw when he became convinced of the merits of statehood by 1954, and he said, "Come on, this is a natural and the initial problem actually was Eisenhower, because here you got this enormously popular American president, and he's skeptical of the whole idea. And one thing I've become convinced of is that, you know, Bob Atwood always thought that Ike really was for statehood, but he just had bad advisors around him from the fishing and canning interests. And I think that's probably not the case. That really Eisenhower just was skeptical of the whole idea, and he thought of Alaska as the Philippines, because he had been in the Philippines with MacArthur before World War II, and he was convinced Alaska was, as he said, it's just an outpost. And he never really became sympathetic to statehood. He went along with it only because his Secretary of Interior, Fred Seaton, Snedden's sort of ally and confidant, convinced him really to go along with it. And it wasn't anything genuine really on Eisenhower's part.
Yeah, you know, but I think Eisenhower did, when you look back at the World War II history and really start examining the Japanese occupying American soil in Alaska, and you know, for an extended period of time, and the hops, the Lend-Lease planes that were going before the United States deigned to enter the war, they were assisting Stalin's Russia with these airplanes that were hopping their way across the Arctic.
Sure.
There was an enormous strategic importance to Alaska that I think you're right, in a sense. Eisenhower thought of it as an outpost, but it was an important outpost. We had a Cold War here, buddy.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think his and it's still actually in the law of the land in the Statehood Act. The remnant of that, you know, Eisenhower's original proposal that he had suggested for statehood said, well, okay, if you want to become a state, how about partitioning Alaska? So that was proposed in 1954, and if you look at the way the boundary lines were drawn, it would have been basically Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Southeast, and there would have been all the North Slope would have been left off, all of Western Alaska and the Aleutians. And this was phenomenally unpopular in Alaska. I mean, matter of fact, it was reviled, this suggestion. And for 3 years, that was the Eisenhower proposal, was that Alaska had to be partitioned, that only part of it would remain a state, and these frontier areas that Ike thought would be strictly under federal control, because he did not want to have the president in a national emergency to have to work with the state government. So the final compromise that's in the Statehood Act was there was no partition. You know, all of Alaska would become a state, but it's what became known as the PIC line, the Porcupine-Yukon-Kuskokwim line. And basically it's the everything north and west of the Porcupine, the Yukon, and then sort of a line down along the Kuskokwim is what was called the Strategic Defense Withdrawal Zone, which the land, and even today it could be done, could be withdrawn by the President of the United States in a national emergency. So that, even though no withdrawals were ever made, it was that proposal in the Statehood Act, which Ted Stevens wrote. That's I think it's Section 10 of the Statehood Act. Is a guarantee, and reflection of the fact of the Cold War, you know, in our own state charter.
Yeah, and it was never used, but there was reserved federal land, and that certainly played an important role in the ultimate statehood determination as well. And I want to get to that with you, Terrence Cole, in a moment. But first, let's talk to Pat, who's joining the program from Stariski Creek, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you.
Hi, Pat.
Yeah. Hi, Terrence.
Hi.
I got two questions for you. First of all, in your research, have you ever come across a territorial flag for the state of Alaska before Benny Benson's?
Not one before, but I've seen suggestions for a territorial flag afterwards, including one, believe it or not, I found in the National Archives that had a picture of Leonard Sepala on it, the dog mushroom. I'm not sure why, but anyway, so Sepala was on the flag. So I mean, I do know why, because he was the great champion dog
right.
musher. But not, I don't think so, Pat. I don't think so.
Your other question, Pat?
Well, since you're a historian taking history and looking forward, since you've studied the 49th and 50th state, would you like to make a venture on what will be the 51st state of the Union?
Well, you know, the one thing that, you know, when we've talked about civil rights and their opponents, that's what they were afraid of. They thought if you admit Alaska and Hawaii, then basically, and one guy actually said this, basically, well, the next state will be Italy. Italy will want to join. And one guy said, you know, that the real reason is not just Italy, but, you know, Guam, the Filipinos, Saipan, Puerto Rico. And then one guy said, yeah, and then Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn. I mean, the whole idea was that they said, once you open the door, the whole world will want to be part of the United States. And so I think we're probably done, unless it's, you know, the District of Columbia, if that ever happened, or Puerto Rico. But Puerto Rico has never showed any real sign of wanting to give up their status not having to pay income tax. So that's the issue, I think, there for them anyway.
Pat, that was a great set of questions. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. See you later, Terrence.
All right, it's Talk of Alaska. Terrence Cole is our guest historian. I want to go back to this conservation lands issue because this is another thing that is unique to your book. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's always been a little strange that this dedicated Republican, C.W. Snedden, publisher of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, was so much in favor of this Arctic Wildlife Range, as they called it at the time, and getting this thing done. And you link this to statehood.
Well, it's pretty, you know, Snedden had these two twin obsessions. One was statehood, and the other was developing North Slope oil and gas, particularly gas, because there had been a big discovery at Gubik, which is right outside the Pet 4. It's right to the east of National Petroleum Reserve Number 4, near where Umiat was developed. And the in 1953-54, it had been proposed to essentially lift all federal restrictions up north. And there had been a big outcry led by Drew Pearson, the newspaper columnist, that this was a giveaway of $50 million worth of federal research, because that's what the government had spent up there in Pet 4. And so basically the idea was dropped, there didn't seem to be any way to open the North Slope to oil or gas. So until 1957, Snedden actually proposed in the summer of 1957. He told Seton, say, you know, what if we get around this sort of opposition by giving the environment, the conservationists, because really the word environmentalist wasn't used then, a dedicated refuge in northeastern Alaska for fishing game, and we lift the restrictions on oil and gas on the rest of the North Slope. So essentially, that's what happened. I mean, he kind of made this political deal that the Arctic Range, and they particularly choose that term range because they didn't want to call it a refuge. They wanted it to be eligible for oil and gas exploration underground, and the original legislation all said that. So create this range and at the same time lift the federal restrictions outside of that range. And that really became the area that Prudhoe Bay was discovered at less than 10 years later. So in a way, it's that... This push by Snedden was a huge thing because unless this federal restriction had been lifted, there would have been no private oil development on the North Slope. And as I like to tell people, you know, many times we sort of think that statehood was inevitable. And that's an absolute distortion because we could have remained a territory. And if things had played out slightly differently, we still might be a territory today. If, for instance, that the state had been delayed another 10 years, there's no way the environmental community in the United States would support giving more than 100 million acres to the people of Alaska to develop the heck out of it, because that's what the state was. The state had its marching orders to we're going to give you all this land, and you're going to develop it as much as you can in order to afford statehood. And that wouldn't have happened 10 years later. So the oil thing was, you're right, is an absolutely crucial part of the story.
All right, thank you. We're talking with Terrence Cole as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AKBusinessMonth or Facebook. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The subject is statehood. Our guest is Terrence Cole, author of CW's Fighting for the 49th Star, CW Sneddon and the Crusade for Alaska Statehood. And Terrence, I have to say one thing I enjoyed so much about this was this kind of cheesy Chamber of Commerce Republican way that that Sneddon operated. I mean, just watching him operate, you know, a newspaper man, a linotype repair man who... even though he's totally committed to the linotype technology, is the first guy to go to offset, one of the first in the nation to go to offset technology to get his newspaper out because it's modern. And all the putting out a special issue of the newspaper that everybody in Congress got, you know, boosting Alaska statehood, all these cheesy little tricks he used to do. They're just wonderful.
Oh, yeah, he was really the classic newspaper man in that way, that he believed there wasn't nothing that he couldn't do with a, you know, with his newspaper, and that his goal was, and particularly in Fairbanks, was sort of, you know, modernizing Alaska and modernizing Fairbanks, and, you know, and those who, you know, I know Fairbanks' reputation for you know, fractiousness is sort of well borne out by the book too, because Sneddon now played a major role in trying to build a community hotel. And And what happened was, you know, we had no good hotels in the early 1950s, and they were all fire traps. And but hotels were so difficult to fund, so he led this big drive, helped promote it to build a community hotel. Really, it was like a pep rally. Everybody in town was supposed to buy $100 and you know, contribute to the hotel. But eventually, the thing collapsed because we couldn't decide where to build it, and there were two sites were only about 200 yards apart, but people wanted either built on the east side of town or west side of town. That's just either side of Cushman Street. So, and I say, you know, they acted like they were hundreds of miles and not hundreds of feet apart. So ultimately, we got a hotel only when we were saved by Wally Hickel, because he half of the money, you know, some of the money that had been raised for this original thing was used as Wally's initial seed capital, and he built the Travelers Inn here in Fairbanks. So, but you're right, he was involved in so many things because our politics here have always been rough and ready, and they still are, but they really were in those days.
To bring it all back home, Larry Golden's called up. Larry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi there, Steve. Hi, Terrence.
Yeah.
Hi, Larry.
I think you're going to bring us back onto the landing strip here, Larry. Yeah. Your documentary, I think, is about to run on public TV in Anchorage, right?
Well, as long as you've given me the perfect lead, in, yes, KAKM will air my documentary Statehood! Thursday, February 24th at 7 p.m. Thanks for the opportunity for that plug, but I actually called to pose a question to Terrence, if I may.
Please.
So, Terrence, you know, you've described very, very aptly, I think, you know, how important it was that Alaska Republicans were involved in this, and that, you know, gave us as a territory the opportunity to talk to Republicans in the Congress, and most importantly, in the administration, and how important all that was. But I'd like to get back a little bit to some of the stuff that was happening in Congress and ask you about, to ask you to tell the audience a little bit about the role of two prominent Democrats in the Congress. Even though a lot of Republicans did vote for statehood in the Senate, there never would have been a bill or never would have been a vote in the Senate if it were not for Lyndon Baines Johnson and the way in which he finessed, the Southern Dixiecrats to drop their sort of a filibuster of the statehood bill, and then also another Texan, Sam Rayburn, over in the House side. If he hadn't come along and pulled some strings to get a vote in the House,
You're absolutely right. Terrence has only got 2 minutes, and that's not enough time for him, Larry. But thanks for that. Lyndon wanted to run for president.
Well, right. I mean, thanks, Larry. I was going to say that he Larry and I are probably the two slowest guys in creation because, his documentary, because I was a little bit faster than Larry, not much, but a documentary, of course, is a lot harder to do. But he's absolutely correct. Sam Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson are absolutely essential. And even Bob Bartlett always said he never knew why those two stood aside. Because they really, if they opposed statehood, we would have never become a state. And I'm positive it's got to be because Johnson was running for president in 1960. And that's, I think, one thing. It may not be Larry and I, in the course when he started early on his documentary and I was working on my book, Larry is the one who said to me, he said, look, it didn't make any sense. Alaska didn't become a state because people like Bob Bartlett. And that's often been alleged by some other writers.
Right, yeah.
So, Johnson's campaign for president is the other part of this puzzle that explains it.
And he had to be perceived as something more than a Southern Democrat.
He did not want to be seen as a Southern segregationist Democrat. He
right.
remodeled himself as a Western progressive Democrat. And admitting Alaska was one way that he did that, to make himself seem more as as not a segregationist, keeping the Democratic Party together.
And then, for those who are not acquainted with this history, Sam Rayburn, a fellow Republican, was running the House and found some parliamentary way to crack the bill out of committee.
Right. I mean, and Rayburn and Johnson are both descended from Confederate soldiers, and they actually were dyed-in-the-wool Southern segregationists, but they played it on both sides, and they were slightly more liberal than some of their other Southern colleagues.
And Alaskans voted for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Oh, thank you so much, Terrence.
Terrence, okay, thanks, Steve.
All right, it's Talk of Alaska. Thanks to Jersey Shedlock and Josh Edge and Dave Waldron. Peace Corps coming up next. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. ANSEP is the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move on to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. To learn more, search ANSEP on the web, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. This message sponsored by ANSEP. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.